Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of RealityCast, I'll be talking to blogger Sadie Doyle about teenage girls, the hookup culture, and the dangers of having boyfriends like Caitlin Flanagan and Sis You Must. Also, the Alana Kagan hearings kick off, and I grapple with the question of so-called conservative feminism. This is only marginally relevant, but I figured it would be fun to link anyway for a little lightheartedness. NPR posted an interview with a psychologist who collects YouTube videos of marriage proposals. Here's one that he likes a lot.
Are you recording that?
Yeah. So she said
don't,
yes.
Don't kill me right now.
She said yes.
Of course I said yes.
I love you.
I
love you more.
I have snot all over my face right now.
And we're walking like we're drunk.
Or we're like, we're drunk on love.
It's a cool article. He observes that women, when getting proposed to, tend to cover their mouths with their hands. This is true of straight women and lesbians, but gay men getting proposed to don't as much. There doesn't seem to be much in the way of women proposing to men on YouTube. And now it's finally time for the Alana Kagan confirmation dog and pony show hearings. I've actually been surprised at how little conservatives raised a fuss about Kagan prior to the hearings. But when the name Thurgood Marshall came up every 2 seconds during the hearings, I realized perhaps why. Now that we have a black president, they're doubling down on the race baiting and maybe laying off some on the gender baiting. That, and they're trying to pretend they're all pro-woman now, which I'll get into in the next segment. Seriously, you would have thought that Marshall was the one being confirmed, not Kagan. She just worked for him a long time ago as a clerk. But once things got underway, the belly aching really began. Let's start with one of the main reasons that Supreme Court justices have become such a big honking deal. Abortion. Megyn Kelly on Fox News went into full-blown lying mode.
She was one of the people who persuaded President Clinton to veto a ban, to not allow a ban on partial birth abortion because she said it needed a health exception. And President Clinton followed that advice, and it took until George Bush got into office to reinstitute that ban. And critics of partial birth abortion, a gruesome procedure, say you put a health exception into that ban, and women can go in, essentially, who abuse the law, for a headache, right, and get an abortion in the third trimester in a way that's very gruesome. So
I counted 3 major lies in 30 seconds, which is far from a Fox News record, but still pretty impressive. The first is that Kagan told Clinton to veto a ban on late-term abortions. On the contrary, she suggested that he sign one proposed by Democrats that had a way too narrow health exception, on the grounds that it would be better than the more serious one that did pass. Lie number 2 is that he took her advice. He didn't. Third is that women get third trimester abortions because they suddenly decide they don't want kids, and they exploit the health exception for this. Again, a complete lie. Even if that was legal, and it's not, there's no doctors who will do it. It just doesn't happen. Bans on late-term abortions are aimed strictly at forcing women with serious health situations to simply not get the care they need. Many Republicans have either decided that a fight against Kagan isn't worth it, or that they like her and so they want her to be confirmed. One major exception, for some reason, is Senator Jeff Sessions. His anger and hostility towards Kagan is completely over the top, and I must admit, I don't get it.
Ms. Kagan has less real legal experience of any nominee in at least 50 years, and it's not just that the nominee has not been a judge. She has barely practiced law, and not with the intensity and duration from which I think real legal understanding occurs. Her actions punished the military and demeaned our soldiers as they were courageously fighting for our country in 2 wars overseas. Ms. Kagan has associated herself with well-known activist judges who have used their power to redefine the meaning of words of our Constitution and laws in ways that, not surprisingly, have the result of advancing that judge's preferred social policies.
He also refused to call her by her title, General Kagan, and insisted on calling her Dean Kagan. On that front, I think he was just trying to draw attention to her history at Harvard Law. That was just plain old anti-intellectualism as a weapon, I think. Sometimes it's hard to pin exactly what the right-wing dog whistles are, but I think that's what's going on there. With Supreme Court confirmation hearings, the usual strategy is for the nominee to attempt to say as little as possible about her own views. The idea is the less you say, the less that your opposition has against you. But Dianne Feinstein did ask about the long-standing precedent that says that abortion cannot be banned post-viability when a woman's health and life are in danger, and how Carhart versus Gonzalez broke that precedent. And this is what Kagan answered.
Senator Feinstein, I do think that the continuing holding of Roe and Doe versus Bolton is that women's life and women's health have to be protected in abortion regulation. Now, the Gonzalez case said that with respect to a particular procedure, that the statute Congress passed, which passed a statute without a health exception and with only a life exception, was appropriate because of the large degree of medical uncertainty involved.
Because of the procedure.
Mm-hmm. But with respect to abortion generally, putting that procedure aside, I think that the continuing holdings of the court are that the woman's life and that the woman's health must be protected in any abortion regulation.
At first, I thought it was a little dodgy, but upon listening to it again, I get what she's saying. She's basically claiming that Carhart only holds for one procedure, and that the relevant precedent going forward is everything before that. Which means, in essence, that she would vote against further attempts to deprive women who need health-saving late-term abortions from gaining access to those abortions. I'd like to welcome Sadie Doyle to the program. Sadie is a writer and a feminist blogger who blogs at Tiger Beatdown on a regular basis. I've asked her on to discuss an article she wrote for The Atlantic titled The Boyfriend Myth. It was a response to one of Caitlin Flanagan's usual pro-patriarchy tirades disguised as concern for women. Welcome to RealityCast, Sadie.
Hi. Thanks for having me so much.
Flanagan's article, titled Love Actually, made what I think is a rather silly argument. Do you mind summarizing what it is?
Well, her argument is that, you know, as time has passed and we move further on from, you know, the sock hops of the 50s, young ladies are becoming more and more used to what's being called the hookup culture, which is what she refers to it as in her piece, and that although they all secretly want boyfriends, which is why they're listening to Taylor Swift sing about boyfriends and why they're watching High School Musical and, I don't know, I think Glee is part of the argument at some point. They're submitting to casual sex with young men, which leaves them hurt and wounded and frustrated and leads to, you know, scary, embarrassing, painful sexual encounters that they don't benefit from. And, I mean, while I actually don't question that casual sex can be grim, as she describes it, the issue with it is that it's sort of ahistorical, you know. I mean, she's talking about how, you know, her mother's generation never would have expected this for her daughters. And her mother is roughly, it sounds like, about Gloria Steinem's age. I mean, Flanagan grew up in the 60s and 70s. She actually probably hasn't lived a tremendous amount of her life in a pre-sexual revolution environment, which means that she's always lived in a time when casual sex, which is now being sort of repackaged as the hookup culture for trend pieces, she's never lived in a time when casual sex wasn't happening. And in fact, the 60s and 70s were kind of known for being very enthusiastic about casual sex. It was, you know, as we moved through the 80s and the AIDS panic kind of came into being, that casual sex began to be looked at again as more problematic, and there was sort of a pullback from that. Is my understanding of the sexual history of the world, and I mean, I'm not a historian, I just write on the internet. But, and I also sort of question the idea that, you know, being heartbroken because a young man doesn't want to be your boyfriend is the worst tragedy that could befall a young woman as she becomes sexually active. You know, that's...
Yeah.
Might very well happen, but when we look at the statistics, we see that people in young relationships, young women ages 16 to 24, are actually in their relationships way more prone to domestic violence even than older women. You know, there's something about young people right now that intimate partner violence is really common, and it may just be because, you know, we live in a world in which intimate partner violence is sadly very common, but it may just be because those young women have maybe a more, you know, I was looking at, you know, the info of domestic violence experts or domestic violence resource sites as I was writing the article, and a lot of them say that it's because, in some part, young women have an overly romantic conception of relationships where it's sort of this twilight thing where if your partner's very possessive and very controlling, that means he likes you, you know, which Flanagan says that the problem is that young women aren't having these very romantic relationships, but in fact over-romanticizing an intimate relationship can be in some senses a risky proposition because it will lead you to be less aware of the warning signs in some ways, given our current picture of romance and, you know, the idea that Robert Pattinson watching you while you sleep is totally sexy and a sign of undying love. And it could also lead you to be more reluctant to leave, honestly. You know, and I mean, I'm sort of generalizing and getting very vague and making these very big conclusions, and I'd love to talk more specifics with you because I think that I'm making sort of large and potentially misleading statements.
Well, I do think you're right. I mean, it's one of the, like, one of the biggest problems for young women is that they do, in fact, buy into the myth that young men cannot be enticed into a relationship unless, you know, it's under very strange circumstances. So if a young man will have you, you should be so slobberingly grateful you'll put up with anything.
Absolutely.
I think one of the things that kind of frustrates me about all of this is that you have this faulty assumption that male behavior, and I think that you agree with Flanagan that young men nowadays, and probably I would say from the beginning of time, have treated young women with a lot of disrespect. But she's operating from this premise that young women have the fundamental control over that. What they do with their vagina really can change young men's behavior. And
exactly.
I've just not really seen, you know, I think what what's interesting about your argument is you're basically saying the boyfriend myth problems that young women have with boyfriends shows that it really isn't true that young women can just simply change young men's behavior by withholding or giving sex.
Exactly. And I mean, that's something that she writes, and that's kind of, I think, placing the onus on girls. She says that the wishes of young women have always been powerful motivators in the lives of young men. But this comes after she's spent quite a while describing young men as like these large, hairy, sex mad behemoths that are manhandling and mistreating girls. I mean, even if we all withheld sex all at once, you know, and said that we wouldn't have sex with you until you invited us to the prom, the guy that's buying the corsage would still be the same guy that was being a jerk a while ago. So I don't really know that that's the most desirable thing. And the fact is that young girls who are in relationships do report being pressured into sex. They do have an exceptionally high rate of sexual assault. And, you know, the idea that this, you know, the disrespect and the poor treatment of young women at the hands of men, what I would call the misogyny of these young men, is influenced by the idea that the girls are just giving it up too easy, and if the boys had to work a little harder, they'd suddenly become nicer and more respectful, is just sort of disproven on the grounds of the facts. I mean, in a relationship or out of a relationship, you can still be sexually assaulted, and it's sort of concern trolling to be like, well, we don't want you hooking up because then you could get yourself, you know, date raped. You could get yourself verbally abused or otherwise maltreated by a man. You know, ultimately, we should be looking at what messages the young men are absorbing about women and, you know, why they're doing this, because the fact is, going out with a guy is no guarantee that he's not a misogynist. He can buy you a big, gorgeous bouquet of a dozen roses bestudded with sparkling dew, and he can still ultimately make the decision to treat you poorly later on.
You focused your article a lot on issues like domestic violence and sexual assault, which I think, you know, it's so critical to talk about that because it's so endemic to young women's lives, and very few people really want to face up to that. But I think a lot of the time these, like, concern trolling about hookup culture articles are based on the premise that that's sort of an extreme thing and that's not what they're talking about. They're just talking about simple heartbreak. Mm-hmm. And they have this image of, I think it's inconceivable to them that young women could be having sex just because they're horny. And instead, it's like they picture that young women sleep with young men and then they get dumped, and that's very sad for them because nobody likes to be dumped. And what always bothers me about that is, do they really honestly think that no one ever gets dumped after dating somebody for a year or 2 years? Or...
Yeah.
I mean, did you have some thoughts on that?
I mean, yeah, ultimately the idea is that, like, you know, you're going out and there's this whole oxytocin pseudoscience that's been floating around all over the place for the longest time, which is that we have oxytocin, which is a bonding hormone, and it's triggered by a lot of things in humans. You know, I mean, there's some research that says that looking at puppies can trigger it, or, you know...
men have it, too.
Yeah, and men have it, too. It's just that women supposedly manufacture more of it, so if we have an orgasm, which, you know, is what triggers the oxytocin. So this is assuming we're all having the orgasms, which, you know, in my experience, that's iffy. If we have these orgasms with these men, we are going to fall in love with them. Our brains will tell us to fall in love with them, and we will have no choice, and we will be scribbling his name on our binder for the rest of the school term. And, you know, the men will just be able to move on, which is why it's very important for us to get the men to love us before we have the orgasms, you know, and fall for them and are ruined forever. I mean, it's really goofy to me because it assumes, I mean, that it just blatantly on the face of it assumes that women can't enjoy casual sex. And this is also... You know, we're talking about teenagers here, and I would sincerely hope that teenagers don't end up dating the same person forever and ever. You know, like, yeah. I mean, if anything, this hookup culture that we're hearing about now, which is really just casual sex, which has been happening for a long time, you know, often among young people, if anything, to me, it signifies that more and more people, including women, are willing to view their early sexuality as a series of experiments that they might not actually consider commitment or, you know, a long-term relationship to be something that they're ready for, but sex is something that they would like to try and sort of figure out. And I'm not coming down unambiguously on the side of hooking up or against boyfriends, because that's silly. I myself have a boyfriend, and I've had several boyfriends, and I'm, you know, I'm one of those people that's actually not really into casual relationships, but to assume that my personal sexuality, which fits a more Flanaganian mode, is somehow true for every single female human being seems to me silly, because if there's one thing we've learned about human sexuality, it's that it comes in a variety of models. And that's the other thing about this article that sort of worried me, because there's sort of a shout-out to Glee at the beginning of it. It's like, well, you know, it says something about, you know, young women and young gay men being united in the quest for a boyfriend, and then the young gay men go away, you know, and it's they're never mentioned again. And girls are pretty unambiguously stated to be on the hunt for a boyfriend. Like, I mean, Lord help them if they want a girlfriend. You know, that's just not in this model of sexuality. So it's just, it's really straightwashing everything. And it's really sort of erasing young women as beings who have sexual urges. Like, I mean, she even says that, for young women of my generation, sex would eventually become pleasurable, but mostly it was a way for us to feel closer to our boyfriends.
My guest today has been Sadie Doyle. You can read more from Sadie at her regular blog, Tiger Beatdown. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Sadie.
Thank you so much, and I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk with you. I got love for you if you were
born. Sometimes I think that social conservatives plan to achieve victory by injecting so many asinine ideas into the mainstream that everyone just gives up trying to think or understand anything. That's got to be Sarah Palin's plan with her running around claiming she's a feminist despite actively opposing a woman's right to have an abortion. The idea appears to be that they can kill feminism by making it such a watered-down term that it's meaningless. It's actually a long-standing and clever strategy of conservatives, which is why they give bills that increase pollution names involving clean air or clean water, or they pass bills that openly flout our nation's founding principles and put the word patriot in the name. Call something what it's not, sow confusion, and then just grab what you want while everyone is trying to figure out what's happening. In a sense, this is good, because conservatives used to try to kill feminism by trying to turn it into a dirty word, even going so far as to coin the term feminazi. Of course, it's worth noting that the actual Nazis opposed feminism as a matter of course, and banned abortion. By trying to embrace the term, they're basically admitting that it has validity and that they intend to take that away. Luckily, Gloria Steinem has gone on the warpath against Palin's attempts to destroy feminism by pretending to be a feminist. She went on Katie Couric's show and explained why there's no such thing as an anti-choice feminist.
I think her calling herself a feminist has mostly to do with how many votes Hillary Clinton got in the presidential race, because, yes, you can be a feminist who doesn't agree with abortion, would never have an abortion, but you can't be a feminist who says that other women can't and criminalizes abortion. One in three American women needs an abortion at some time in her life. To make that criminal and dangerous is not a feminist act, and that is the position of Sarah Palin.
This gets right to the heart of it. The so-called pro-life feminists aren't simply feminists who object to abortion on moral grounds. If that was so, they would be able to achieve their ends by simply not getting abortions. But every so-called pro-life feminist out there is basically demanding a ban on abortion, even for those of us who don't have moral qualms about abortion. Depriving individual women of the basic religious freedom to decide for yourself how you feel about what's basically a religious question? Setting women aside as a class that isn't considered smart enough to make these choices for ourselves? Not feminist. Jamieu Green poo-pooed the idea that feminism is simply about women being chauvinists that simply support other women because they're women.
I think that most feminists do not make their voting decisions based on our reproductive organs. It is about the issues and are you promoting the sentiment, the values, and our rights that are clearly important. And I would say that Sarah Palin does not represent many of those same sentiments.
In what way? I mean, why?
Well, clearly she wants the government to intervene in family planning decisions and to have the government come into my home or your home and make medical decisions for us. And that, to me, is goes absolutely against any feminist principle I grew up learning.
I think this is where a lot of conservatives get confused. They see a long history of male dominance, of men passing laws and restrictions to keep women away from holding the reins of power. So they assume feminists just want to flip the equation, and that therefore we think any woman is better than a man. In reality, it's about equality and what policies support female equality. And sometimes female politicians aren't supporting policies that help achieve that goal. And sometimes female politicians aren't supporting policies that help achieve this goal. Or whatever Palin is, I suppose at this point she's more an opportunist and a pundit than a politician. Steinem went on the Colbert Report, and she and Stephen Colbert made fun of this whole misconception of feminism.
We listened to the show about how basically men are coming to an end. It's over for us. Are you happy that women have won?
No.
Because you're one of the reasons why. You're one of the generals of this movement.
No, the idea was never victory and defeat. You know, the whole idea was, you should pardon the expression, equality. You know, that we're actual human beings, and that was it. I mean, you know, I know it sounds radical, but that was it.
What I really love about Colbert is that he's really in tune with these feminist issues, which is in great contrast to The Daily Show. And he's really got this ridiculous claim that there's such a thing as a conservative feminist down cold, and really knows how to parody it.
And the problem is, and listen, I'm a feminist. I'm a feminish.
You're a feminist.
I'm a feminish.
Okay, but
I'm a feminish.
How do you reconcile that with Rush Limbaugh and feminazi?
That's an excellent question, because we have the real story this year is how the Republicans are putting all the strong ladies out there. You got Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina out there. Of course, Sarah Palin tearing up the pee patch all over the place. Do you feel proud that it has been embraced by the Republican Party and they're putting out all the great ladies right now? Like, I think there are more Republican women holding office than Democratic women right now.
No, I don't think so. But anyway,
I don't think so either. But it sure feels that way if you look at the press right now.
And they're right, of course. Conservative women get a lot of press mostly because it's a man bites dog story. Women out there fighting against women's rights. It's also what a still sexist establishment wants to hear. Contrary to the hype, Democratic women far outnumber Republican women in office, to the tune of 3-1. There are 13 female Democratic senators versus 4 Republicans, and 56 Democratic congresswomen compared to 17 Republicans. The sad thing is that women are way outnumbered by men in both parties. Plus, some of these conservative women think that God wants you to have a rapist baby. Sharon Engel went straight for the God wants you to be raped and pregnant thing.
So in others, rape and incest would not be something?
You know, I'm a Christian.
Right.
And I believe that God has a plan and a purpose for each one of our lives, and that he can intercede in all kinds of situations, and we need to have a little faith in many things.
Or she's saying that if you get pregnant from rape, God will abort for you with a miscarriage, which is a pretty cruel thing to tell a rape victim. I can't tell, but either way, it's not feminist. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts, denying rights because of the ick factor edition. Ariel Levy interviewed Mike Huckabee about why he's against gay rights. And swear to God, this is what he said.
You say this about gay marriage. We can get into the ick factor, but the fact is, two men in a relationship, two women in a relationship, biologically, that doesn't work the same. A group called the Human Rights Campaign responded, ick is certainly an appropriate way to describe Mr. Huckabee's mind going into sex when all that we're asking for is our equality.
His defense of these statements is nonsensical, though you can click the link and listen to it yourself. Personally, I couldn't take his condescending chuckling 1 second longer, so I'm not going to subject you to it against your will. All I'm saying is this. Nothing makes me want to puke on my shoes more than thinking of Mike Huckabee getting it on. So I suppose by his own standards that he shouldn't be allowed to be married.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.